Okay, so the last speaker for this session is Stephen Porter, who's is at the University of Washington. And if you take a look at his CV and his publication list, it's just a sort of an extraordinary thing. And he appears to have walked most of the world. Is that right? I mean, would you say that you have walked thousands of kilometers? Yeah, so you've individually sustained the Italian shoe industry, I guess. So. Today you're going to speak, a very limited piece of your research, or perhaps you're going to give us a summation, I don't know. But you're going to speak about the quaternary chronology of two terrestrial climate proxies, right? And so, if you just want to take a look at the amount of work this guy has done, I recommend just looking up his CV. It's just extraordinary. He's worked on Antarctica, South America, North America, Europe, the Pacific Islands, China. It's quite impressive. So, Stephen Porter.
Yeah, that's great. I'm going to start at the beginning here, because the beginning for me was in Kirtland Hall, and actually my time at Yale ended in Kirtland Hall. So I have a fondness in my heart for this Triassic sandstone reddish building, even though it is no longer under the purview of the Department of Geological Sciences. I spent part of my undergraduate years at Peabody Museum under the bursary program. In order to get some funds to get through, they gave you a job. And I was assigned to Joe Gregory, vertebrate paleontologist in the museum, who assigned me the task of unpacking some packages down in the basement of the Peabody Museum, actually wooden crates that contained the fossils from Wyoming that O.C. March had collected and shipped to the campus. And then they had just been put in storage, and no one had ever seen them since the 1870s when Marsh sent them. So my obligation here was to unpack, to clean somewhat, and to catalog and organize the collections. That's a National Geographic mosasaur on there, incidentally. I suspect not all of you know this famous geologist on the left. This is probably one of Yale's most famous geologists, Clarence King, who was leader of the 40th Parallel Survey and founder of the U.S. Geological Survey, and wrote a very popular book, which is still in print, Mountaineering in the Sierra Nevada. So he was a mountaineer geologist. And on the other side here of the screen is a picture of a member of the Yale Mountaineering Club back in the 1950s climbing comparable terrain. And this was on Ragged Mountain in above us in Connecticut. Now, graduate students today, I guess, have pretty nice offices by comparison with what was available in Johnson Hall. This is the room in which geology graduate students had little cubby holes. They measured about 3 feet by 4 feet, and you're looking here at six or seven individual little office spaces there. Needless to say, the noise level sometime was above average, but it was pretty good digs for those days. It was called informally the rat's nest. I was at Yale at a time when there was a very distinguished older faculty. And I just have a few pictures here to show you. But in the upper left is Chester Longwell, who was working in John Rogers' office. And John Rogers was giving me advice on my dissertation. And the next picture is of Carl Dunbar and his stratigraphy class at one of his famous field trips through the Paleozoic rocks of the eastern part of New York. And then the other three down here, Dick Flint, John Rogers, and Link Washburn, were all primary members of my dissertation committee. And I worked closely with Flint, who was an amazing individual, actually. He was, he not only wrote famous textbooks, but he gave a popular lecture in the department back in those days. And I was amazed to see him when he was composing his papers and books, because he would sit at his desk in his office with a pencil and a yellow pad, and he would carefully write out what he wanted to say. And that was the first draft and final draft in most cases. So he was a perfectionist, but nevertheless produced excellent grammar. And then I threw this picture in just for your interest. This is the 1957-58 class. And if you look closely at this, you'll see a number of people in this picture who are in the room today. There's something else that is of note, two other things that are of note in this picture. If you looked over in Klein yesterday, you could have seen pictures similar to this of various classes extending into the past. And what you see in this class is that every one of the men, and notice there's only one woman in there, are wearing jackets and ties. And if you go and look at the recent photographs down in Klein, you'll find that it's hardly any jackets and ties. It's very informal. And the other thing is that the percentage of women in the picture is vastly larger than what you see here in this 1958 picture. And some of the men in here had more hair and were a little... Yeah, and there's Carl Tarikian up there in the upper left, looking very young and trim. Now, when we were in Yale back in the 1950s, there were a number of things that we knew. We knew this because our professors taught us, and it appeared in all the textbooks that we were using. For instance, and I'm going to deal on topics that relate to my own work, the Pleistocene began 1 million years ago. There were 4 Pleistocene glaciations in North America and Europe, and 5 in the Alps. Alpine glaciers fluctuated in phase and relative magnitude with the large Pleistocene ice sheets. And the Kroll-Milankovitch theory was considered inadequate to explain Pleistocene climate changes. Some of the things we didn't have or did not anticipate in the late 1950s, when I was getting into graduate school, plate tectonics had not arrived and did not arrive for about half a dozen years after I got my PhD, creating me some problems, needless to say, because my dissertation was not just on quaternary glaciation, but it also was on Paleozoic stratigraphy and chronology and tectonics of the North Central Brooks Range. And not having plate tectonics as a possible means of explaining some of the phenomena there was obviously a shortcoming. We lacked long ice and marine core paleoclimatic time series. We also lacked the array of advanced dating techniques which are so commonly used now. And these include the ones you see here, AMS, radiocarbon, magnetic reversal chronologies, potassium-argon, electron spin resonance, optically stimulated luminescence, fission track, amino acid, cosmogenic isotopes. And this is an amazing array. When I was working on alpine glaciers back in the 1950s and 60s, and even much more later than that, the only dating technique we had was radiocarbon. And datable organic matter was very infrequently found associated with alpine glaciers. And the other one, in the Cascades at least, was tephra chronology, the use of widespread tephra layers. In both cases, they were useful mainly in the Holocene and often in the late part of the Holocene. So the earlier portions were just based on intelligent guesses. And of course, we lacked high-speed desktop computers. And we also lacked affirmation of the Kroll-Milankovitch theory. Now, what I propose to do today is to give you two examples of terrestrial paleoclimatic data that come from places that I have been working in over the last 25, 30 years or so. And the Chinese Los Paleosol record, I think, is the most amazing example of this, of any continuous time series that we have from land. And this is continuous. There are soils in amongst the list layers in China, but these soils are accretionary soils, which means that dust was accumulating while the soils were forming. The focus of most of the work on Chinese Lus is in the Lus Plateau, which is inside the big bend of the Yellow River that you see there. And what this picture shows is the isopachs, the thickness of the most recent glacial Lus deposit here, and you can see that it decreases in thickness from 30 meters or more down to about 5 or 6 meters as we get into the lower part of the Yellow River. Now, this is only one of the numerous Lus layers that we find in the Chinese Lus Plateau. Incidentally, if we were to carry our sampling off to the east, you would eventually find that Chinese Lus is deposited over the eastern seaboard. It's been found in Japan. It also has been found in the Hawaiian Islands as a component of the soils. And there it stands out because, although the particles are very tiny, they consist of quartz. And, of course, there's no native quartz in Hawaii. And what this means is, as well, if you project it still farther, that Chinese Lus undoubtedly landed in North America, in the western part of it, but it cannot be identified. Now, the diagram I showed at the beginning of a man standing by a column of Lus was looking at the section that's shown here. The Chinese have subdivided the Lus into units called L1, L2, L3, L4, and then the paleosols, which are shown, several of them shown here, are S0 and S1 down below. So we have a package, a stratigraphic package, which is repeated as one goes from the surface down into the geologic section. And the marine oxygen isotope stages and substage correlations here are based in part, when this diagram was put together, mainly on the similarity between the Lus stratigraphy and the deep sea chronology. It's staggering to stand at a distance and see the thickness of the Lus. Here is a diagram off in the direction of Lanzhou, and there the Lus lies above a horizon here, which is consists of terrace gravels. This is a terrace of the Yellow River, and the holes that you see along there are where the gravel is being mined, and the layer of terrace gravel is about 3 meters thick, to give you some idea of the thickness of the overlying Lus. In the western part of the Lus Plateau, the entire Lus section that's preserved is on the order of 200 or 300 meters thick. Below it is a red clay, the so-called red clay, which is a reddish horizon which has bedding in it, and which in recent years has been reinterpreted as simply a continuation of the Lus paleosol sequence downward below the main Lus body up above. Now, here's a section through the Lus paleosol sequence in the vicinity of Xi'an, and what looks like a little toy truck down there is a big, big, huge toy truck about to enter a tunnel that you see on the left side there. And I've identified the uppermost layers starting at the surface. The first paleosol one reaches is S1, and then S2, S3, S4, and so forth on down to marine isotope stage 22. And then all the other units down below can be identified as well. There are marker horizons in here which are useful for regional correlations, and these include Lus number 9, which is not only thick, but sandy. And list number 15, which is similarly sandy, and at a place within the list sequence that matches the timing of marine oxygen isotope stages. Now, in just the last few years, sections have been studied that extend back beyond through the red clay and into the later part of the Pliocene. And what the parameters that are used for correlation include the magnetic reversal chronology shown in the leftmost of these columns, the magnetic susceptibility, which varies throughout the section as well, having higher amplitude and less frequency as you get up towards the upper part of the section. And then there's also the mean grain size shown on there as well. And over on the right side are two diagrams there. One is the dust accumulation rate on the right, and it shows that dust fall was relatively low until about 3 million years ago, and then it began to increase. And also in Gansu, there's a record that extends the magnetic susceptibility from the surface where it's relatively high down into isotope stage 22 where it is much lower. The lists and magnetic stratigraphy here, which are shown on the middle of the diagram, show the dating in the upper part of this particular section, which is the Malan list, the last glacial list, with radiocarbon control in the range of 6,000 to 2,000 years. And then below that, OSL dating has been instrumental in trying to correlate and date the lower parts of the record. Also, you can see other parameters are being investigated with these cores that have come in, including beta, 10 beta, the 10 beta concentration, the dry bulk density, and the dust flux. And in all cases, the correlations look reasonably consistent. Now, part of the studies in the Lewis Plateau involved looking at the Holocene part of the record too. And what one finds there over the last 12,000 years are a series of list layers that are interstratified with paleosols. The paleosols have peat in them, or associated with them, or organic silts, and represent times of strong summer monsoon activity. The loess and dune sand, which are shown by these horizontal lines, lack any organic matter, and these represent high influx of dust. The diagram shows remarkably coincidence with the percentage of North Atlantic drift ice tracers, which Gerard Bond and colleagues have produced, and there's a one-to-one ratio down here going all the way down through the Holocene, and we can find here a record then of neoglacial loess in the upper part where it says onset of neoglaciation over there, and then below it the record extends down to the Younger Dryas. Now, for the last 15 years, we've been working in the northeastern part of the Tibetan Plateau around China's biggest inland lake, Qinghai Lake, or Koko Nor if you speak Mongolian. And I've been working along the southern margin of this and the adjacent mountains. There's a mountain range in the just to the south of the lake, the Qinghai Nanshan, and then other mountains up to the north. So this lake, which is an interior basin lake, has fluctuated in amplitude, and it lies just on top of the hill above those thick list deposits that you saw a few moments ago down there. And the amazing thing is, we had gone up into this area thinking we would see at least part of that list sequence, since it lies right next door to it. But in all the work we've done in there, we've not found any list that is older than Holocene. And here's a typical column of list that one sees up near the lake, where post-glacial list has OSL dates of ranging from 15 to 5,000 years ago. But it rests on an alluvial unit, which is mid-isotope stage 3, and dates 30 to 15,000 years ago. But there's a disconformity and a discontinuous paleocell separating the loess and the gravel that dates to MIS-2. So there's a large disconformity in the middle of this section, which is represents a glacial hiatus. So on top of this gravel, there was a weak paleocell developed, and there are ice wedge casts as well. So we have a nice interval in there from about 30 to 15,000 years ago that represent the last glaciation. Oops. I should point out here that the scale is a young lady who got her undergraduate degree in mathematics at Yale with honors. And she decided, however, not to pursue mathematics as her primary goal. And so she became a late Precambrian paleontologist and shifted her office to Harvard University. She now teaches at the University of California at Santa Barbara, and her name is Susanna Porter. Now, so much for my little introduction to Chinese loess and paleocells. I have enough to give several hour lectures on those, but I'll switch to Cascade glaciations, since that was one of the main themes here. And one of the problems, of course, in Cascade glaciations has always been that there are very few ways that one can adequately date them. Up until the time that the deep sea core chronology became well established, about 1960 or so, it was widely thought that there were four Pleistocene glaciations during the last million years, which was defined as the Pleistocene at that time. And this chronology was a result of work done in the Alps by Albert Penck and Edward Bruckner, who published a massive three-volume work on the ice age of the last million years. And if you've read any of the ice age literature, you're probably aware of the four primary glacial events in the Alps, the Würm, Riss, Mindel, and Gunz. And the chronology is estimated, and it's based not on stratigraphy, but on snow line depression, the amount of snow line calculations. In 1965, my friend Wally Broker, in writing a summary paper on geochemistry in the volume on the Pleistocene and on the Quaternary, stated that the chlorine 36 method offers one of the few hopes for establishing the ages of mountain glaciation. And he was right on target there. It took 20 to 30 years before people started using chlorine 36 because there were instrumental problems over the initial part of that time. But there's been a resurgence of dating now taking place in the American West as well as around the world. And there are probably more than 1,000 chlorine 36 ages now that have accumulated. The one I'm going to talk about here, the example, is Icicle Creek. The glacier of Icicle Creek is reconstructed in this map. And down in the lower end, down where the words Boundary Butte occur, there are lateral moraines, which together with those in the main valley, number 8 successive glaciations. This is a boulder on one of the moraines, and This drainage has some of the largest boulders and marinal boulders that I've seen anywhere. But here we are collecting a sample from the top for chlorine 36 dating, and you can see down here, well, you can see most of it anyway. Whoops. Oh, my. Where's our expert? Okay. I found the right button, I think. Okay, here's the chlorine 36 ages we have for these moraines, and they include the late glacial Rat Creek moraine, which has an age, cosmogenic isotope age, that is equal to the Younger Dryas. So there's the latest of the main moraines, Younger Dryas age. The Leavenworth one is the last glacial maximum. And then there are three older ones which extend back to 105 to 112,000 years. And most of the dating that has been done on alpine moraine so far has been restricted to the last glaciation. If one compares the Icicle Creek glacial record to the mean insolation, July insolation at this latitude, 47 degrees north, you see that there is a one-to-one correlation between the moraine ages and the peaks in mean July insolation. And the amazing thing here was that the maximum glaciation, the last glaciation with the greatest extent of ice, occurred during this insolation minimum at 114,000 years. In other words, it was not separated from the earlier stages. Let me move on here. Here is the July insolation record for this drainage basin that extends from the present back to 1,000, back to 1 million years ago. And the different amplitudes of these various moraines suggest that only the maximum are preserved, that there is a long interval in here when the amplitude of the July insolation is restricted, then we can pick up the evidence for the glacial ages being progressively less extensive as we approach the present. We have found no older moraines older than about 200,000 years, and this probably is due to the weathering rate. As you get farther back in time, the granite weathers, and boulders which might appear in the youngest moraines are diminished in size up to 2 to 10 meters because of in situ weathering. Now, in comparing the insolation minima with the glacial record, I want to call your attention to something that is rather interesting, and this is work that's been done recently by Bill Ruderman, who has advocated that there was, based on the evidence from Taylor Dome records and methane parts per million observed, that there was a change in the amount of observed there is a change in the direction that the solar radiation curve went at about 5,000 years ago. And the CH4 trend rose as the, instead of going down the dotted line, as one would expect it to do. And the same is true in the CO2 trend, which instead of following the natural CO2 trend, takes off about 8,000 years ago and then increases by 40 parts per million. So Ruderman, in one of his most recent publications, said without any anthropogenic warming, Earth's climate would no longer be in a full interglacial state, but well on its way toward the colder temperatures typical of glaciations. In other words, a glaciation has been aborted, according to this hypothesis, because of the increased early Holocene and mid-Holocene increase in CO2 and CH4. Well, in this final slide, I want to point out, here's the July insolation record, or this is the July insolation curve for this glacier at Icicle Creek. And the natural trend is shown on the left. The trend of full glacial snow line is shown on the right, and there's a coincidence between the snow line and the insolation here that takes off in the Holocene and doesn't follow what would presume to be the natural trend. And what this does, if it, the change in the curve, assuming it would naturally follow the other trend, shows that when the CO2 onset of increased atmospheric gas as well as CH4 at 8,000 and 5,000 years ago, we end up with a glacial record here based on snow line reconstructions that is similar to what Ruderman proposed in his several papers on this. If we project the curve from the present into the future, assuming that anthropogenic CO2 warming and methane warming is going to occur, well, then we have an anomalous record here compared to the natural trends that we find for older events. So in this case, this glacial record does support the notion that there was an aborted glaciation and that we should be without this early atmospheric gas input to the atmosphere, we should be well on our way towards another glaciation following the natural trend. Well, thank you.